The issue of who decides what you can or can't read was really the crux of the case.
As a group of people who have undergone seizures after seizures and decades of struggle against Canada Customs, we feel enormously vindicated.
This win for all Canadians is due in great measure to the wonderful shamelessness of the clients of the Civil Liberties Association, who have refused to be ashamed of how they live and act and imagine and communicate with one another about their sexuality.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Australia's marriage equality plebiscite meets political pandemonium. A Texas judge blocks Obama's trans student guidelines. And the bookstore storm that brought Canada a reading rainbow. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 27th, 2016. The battle in Australia over the government's proposed plebiscite on civil marriage equality got even messier this week. Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull first promised that the public vote on opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples would be held before the end of the year. But he said this week that it probably wouldn't happen until February 2017 at the earliest. Parliament, which begins its new session on August 30th, must first approve a bill to hold the plebiscite, and even passage of that proposal may be in question. Its opponents have stiffened their resolve to prevent the non-binding $160 million referendum, which will require all eligible voters to participate or be fined, but won't require MPs, who staunchly oppose civil marriage equality, to ratify the result. Poll after poll confirms as much as 70% of the Australian public supports allowing same-gender couples to legally marry. Another reason why its opponents also say that the pointless plebiscite will simply confirm the obvious.
Equality advocates have also expressed fears that the political campaign over the plebiscite will foster homophobic rhetoric and possibly even violence, affecting younger LGBT people in particular. They also warn that even the way the question will be framed, a draft of which was leaked this week, could allow anti-equality forces to water down a civil marriage equality bill at the legislative stage. The plebiscite question will read, "Do you approve of a law to permit people of the same sex to marry?" But a yes vote wouldn't specifically mandate equalizing all civil marriage laws to include same-gender couples, which could lead to the creation of less-than-equal gay and lesbian civil unions. Opponents of the plebiscite also say that results of recent national elections suggest majority support now exists for a civil marriage equality bill in Parliament, but only if all MPs are allowed a free vote, which Prime Minister Turnbull has ruled out. He seems to be in the uncomfortable position of trying to balance the views of far-right MPs in his coalition government, who resolutely oppose civil marriage equality, and the increasing pressure on him by some members of his own Liberal Party to support a free vote.
The Greens, a significant minority party in Australia, also want a free vote and formally confirmed this week that its members would be voting against the plebiscite. Opposition Labour Party MPs may do the same, which could scuttle the public vote altogether. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, 38 votes are required to block legislation in the Senate. That total could be achieved with a combination of all 26 Labour senators, 9 Greens, and 3 Independents who are on record against the plebiscite. But Liberal Party leaders are warning that the civil marriage equality issue will be decided by the plebiscite or not at all. They hinted that a vote against the plebiscite could be the death of any chance of civil marriage equality in Australia for the next 3 years.
The marriage plebiscite is something which I've been on the record as opposing, and a lot of my colleagues have. I think legislating this issue is a far better way of dealing with it than the plebiscite.
Labour Party leader Bill Shorten raked the Turnbull government over the coals for the current quagmire during a speech this week at the National Press Club.
How is it that Australians will be compelled to vote in a plebiscite which Mr Turnbull's backbench will not be compelled to accept? How is it that Australians could be fined for not voting on the plebiscite Yeah, Mr Turnbull's people will have a leave pass not to vote after the plebiscite in the manner of the plebiscite decision. It's nonsense, isn't it? $160 million? Now, I know the government say, and some of the anti-marriage equality people say, oh, you've got to let the people decide. Well, the people vote for their MPs. MPs have got views on this. $160 million, compulsory, people will be fined, and yet the government backbench and ministers don't have to buy the decision? You and I both know it's nonsense.
That was Australian Opposition Labor Party leader Bill Shorten.
It's been a somewhat disappointing week for transgender people and their supporters in the United States. U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor granted the request by Texas and a dozen other states for a preliminary injunction against the Obama administration's recently announced guidelines that trans students and employees at federally funded public schools and universities be allowed to use the bathrooms that match their gender identity. The still-to-be-litigated lawsuit accuses the Obama administration of conspiring to turn workplaces and educational settings across the country into laboratories for a massive social experiment, flouting the democratic process and running roughshod over common-sense policies protecting children and basic privacy rights. Judge O'Connor, who's based in Fort Worth, Texas, and is an appointee of George W. Bush, wrote in his order for the preliminary injunction that the Obama administration wants to unlawfully require the plaintiff states to abide by the guidelines without exception or be in breach of their obligations.
But a coalition of leading U.S. LGBT advocacy groups, including Lambda Legal, the ACLU, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the Transgender Law Center, issued a joint statement noting that it's just one judge and one lower court ruling. They point out that it flies in the face of clear legal precedent nationwide establishing that transgender students have the right to go to school without being singled out for discrimination. The other states involved in the lawsuit are Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Utah, West Virginia, and Wisconsin.
Texas and four other Republican-led states filed another lawsuit this week, challenging recently announced Obama administration regulations that ban bias against transgender people by healthcare professionals and insurers. The suit charges that the new rules force doctors to violate their religious beliefs by treating such patients. Service providers who accept federal funding are required to comply with the new regulations. Joining Texas in this lawsuit are Kansas, Kentucky, Nebraska, and Wisconsin, along with the Christian Medical and Dental Association and Franciscan Alliance, an Indiana-based network of religious hospitals. Jillian Weiss of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund noted that 10 states and Washington, D.C. already require private insurers to cover transgender health care, while 6 states and the nation's capital cover such services through their Medicaid programs. The only thing a doctor is obliged to do, she said, is treat all patients, including trans patients, with dignity and respect. If a doctor has a sound, evidence-based medical reason to delay transition care for a specific patient, that would be respected under the regulations. The lawsuit also challenges provisions of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, that require insurance providers to cover abortion services. The case has been assigned to Judge Reed O'Connor, who earlier in the week ruled against enforcement of the Obama administration's guidelines for the fair treatment of transgender students at federally funded schools and universities.
But a ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Thomas Schroeder on August 26th temporarily barred the University of North Carolina from enforcing the anti-transgender parts of the Tar Heel State's infamous HB2. Which also bans local governments from protecting their LGBT citizens from discrimination. Schroeder, also an appointee of George W. Bush, granted the request by the transgender plaintiffs who are suing the state of North Carolina over the constitutionality of the law. He cited a recent case from Virginia in which the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the Obama administration's interpretation of federal civil rights laws banning discrimination based on sex to also protect transgender people. Police officials across North Carolina have already declared the so-called bathroom bill provisions of HB2 to be realistically unenforceable.
And finally, this week's annual Pride celebration in Charlotte, North Carolina, set new attendance records. An estimated 200,000 people went to the parade and festival. Organizers said more than 3,500 people, another record number, marched in the parade itself. According to Charlotte television station WBTV, the growth of the parade and festival led city officials to declare them extraordinary events for the first time ever, which required a larger police presence. A small but obnoxious group of religious fundamentalist protesters along the parade route failed to dampen the festive mood, and no physical confrontations were reported. Many people attributed the record crowd of LGBT people and their allies at the Pride celebration this year to the passage of HB 2, which has galvanized human rights advocates across the state. The Charlotte Observer noticed another sign of changing times. Compared to one church entry in the city's first Pride parade in 1994, there were more than a dozen faith groups among the 135 contingents in the parade this year.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending August 27th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
A good read can start a revolution. It was true in the past, it's true now, and it'll be true later in the program. If the 53 out athletes there had actually competed as Team LGBT, by the end of the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, they would have ranked 16th among the medal-winning nations. From boxing to basketball, dressage to diving, they brought home 5 gold medals, 6 silver, and 3 bronze. With 35% of the LGBT players reaching the podium, they whipped the daylights out of several countries where their very existence is denied, and set the stage for the number of openly queer participants to double again for the 2020 Games. Chances are their thrilling victories were cheered on by another kind of gold winner, one who might have carried their torch years ago had his life not taken a different path.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view.
Johnny Mathis, pop music icon, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Born in 1935 in Texas and raised in San Francisco, Johnny Mathis remains one of the most successful recording artists in the world. His father bought him a used piano at age 8 and arranged free voice lessons with opera singer Connie Cox. She taught Johnny to sing the soft, high notes that would become his trademark. Excelling on the track team in high school and college, he seemed destined for the 1956 Olympics. But fate had other plans for him. Producing hits like Chances Are, he proved to be one of the most gifted interpreters of romantic ballads in the history of American popular music. His greatest hits album remained on Billboard's pop chart for 10 years. In 1982, Mathis came out in Us magazine speaking of his first love at the tender age of 16. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Gene Templeton.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
Most people didn't even realize that some random person in a suit was deciding what you could or couldn't read.
We'll hear how a British Columbia bookstore sounded the swan song for Canada's suited censors. But first, queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason takes a look at a book that, in some places, might have its own problems crossing borders.
When I read the gay-themed novel Guapa by Salim Haddad, Other Press, New York, 2016. I reflected on the fact that we are a human family. We have more in common than not, and often there is considerable overlap between identities. The narrator is not from a religious family, but he is grappling with homophobia in a deeply religious culture that includes checkpoints, revolution, and a deep connection to family. When the narrator reflects back on his adolescence, he gives voice to the same sentiments, unfortunately, that many, if not most, young people feel regardless of their religion or country of origin. I was different from everyone else. I was doomed to be alone. I was going to spend eternity rotting in hell. The narrator attends college in America, where he also grapples with homophobia and what he describes his Arabness and all that entails. When he comes back to the Middle East and moves back in with his grandmother who raised him, he finally falls in love, only to face more struggles. The narrator writes of his lover, "He was right when he told me once that he had 1 foot in and 1 foot out. It was a balancing act, and he navigated it so effortlessly. But I was his 1 foot out, wasn't I? In fact, he made sure I never met his mother. He introduced me to his father once, a few years ago, at the wedding of his distant cousins. I remember being surprised at how tall his father was, but like Tamar, he was very handsome." Unfortunately, Guapa is an all-too-familiar story, but it is a good one and worth reading. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio news magazine produced by, about, and for our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Canada's LGBT rights movement was going strong in the 10 years preceding national marriage equality. The CITR-FM Vancouver documentary Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 covers those watershed years. In part three of This Way Out's incremental rebroadcast, producer Heather Kitching looks at the culmination of an extended legal battle that helped make her adopted hometown of Vancouver, British Columbia, an activist hotbed.
I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage. At the end of 2000, queers scored a partial victory in a massive battle that dated back to 1990. It was a fight between Little Sisters Bookstore and the Canada Border Services Agency, which used to be called Canada Customs.
My name is Ken Bosom. I have been working at Little Sisters for almost 11 years. So Little Sisters actually opened in 1983, and then they started becoming aware that they were really being targeted. It actually started with a copy of The Advocate, which is not really porny at all. It's like a news magazine, really. It was seized by Canada Customs, who is now Border Services Agency. Somebody at Customs had opened the package or the box that contained the magazines, and they didn't like the way it looked. It made them feel funny inside, whatever. And consequently, the magazines weren't delivered. And so this would happen over and over and over again. Books didn't come, and then 1 year, their entire shipment of stuff, pretty much, for Christmas, didn't arrive. Finally, Celia Duffy, who used to be the owner of a really prominent book chain in Vancouver just before the first round of the case, she said, "Well, what are the titles that you're having trouble with?" And so she turned around and ordered in all of those titles, and all of them came through with no problem at all. And so it became clear that it was just that the store was being targeted because it was gay or lesbian. Jim, if for those who knew him, was a very feisty little banty rooster from the prairies. He was not going to take that sitting down. So the store filed suit against Canada Customs.
In order to understand this story, it helps to understand a little bit about how border services works. Agents are allowed to intercept packages coming across the border and seize items that are banned in Canada. Most of those banned items are pretty easy to spot. Guns, drugs, certain exotic animals, for example. But Canada also has laws against obscene reading material, and that means that border agents are also de facto censors. They're allowed to hold shipments of books and magazines and videos at the border while they figure out if anything in them is obscene. That power is known as prior restraint. Here's Ken Bosom.
The issue of who decides what you can or can't read was really the crux of the case. The man who used to be the book buyer at the store, Mark McDonald, he's commented that there are people on the front line whose job it is to make sure that there isn't, you know, a potato beetle on your farm vehicle that's coming into the country. And those same people that are supposed to be making those choices are somehow supposed to choose whether or not you're allowed to read about this, that, or the other thing, you know. Any citizen could order a book and have their package detained at the border, and it became a case of guilty until proven innocent if you were the person trying to bring that in. So then the onus was on you financially and legally to prove to the country, essentially, that it was a safe and okay book or magazine to bring in.
Little Sisters asked the court to remove Border Services' power of prior restraint altogether. It said the agency was so homophobic and so useless at judging the artistic merit of literature that it was violating gay people's constitutional right to equality. It said the system was too broken to fix. The Supreme Court of Canada handed down its decision on December 15, 2000. This is John Dixon from the BC Civil Liberties Association speaking at a press conference at the bookstore.
We've won. We didn't win everything we wanted. The court didn't accept our plea to strike down the Customs Act in its entirety, insofar as it gives them the power to seize books, but it said this: no more reverse onus. No more will it be the case in Canada that an importer of books or magazines or videos must take up the onus or burden of proving that those materials are not obscene. If the government wants to seize it at the border, the government is going to have to prove that it is obscene in a court of law. And a clock will run. At the end of 30 days, the government must be willing to go into a court of law and prove that the matter is obscene. This changes, in our view, utterly the nature of the relationship of Little Sisters to customs, and it changes utterly the relationship of Canadians to expression materials in general. And this win for all Canadians is due in great measure to the wonderful shamelessness of the clients of the Civil Liberties Association, who have refused to be ashamed of who they are, have refused to be ashamed of how they live and act and imagine and communicate with one another about their sexuality. And I congratulate them.
Thank you.
This is Little Sisters manager, Janine Fuller.
As a store, as a group of people who have undergone seizures after seizures and decades of struggle against Canada Customs, we feel enormously vindicated that the Supreme Court has reconsidered how Canada Customs has to operate in this country.
Here's Ken Bosom.
The significance of decision in the end is sort of multiple. It's really one of the first few cases where the gay community really stood up to the government, and I think it's one of the first big cases where everybody was really on board with it, because it involved ideas and it was like people telling us we couldn't think things, we couldn't write things. And so I think it really raised the awareness of most Canadians that this was even a thing. Like, most people didn't even realize that some random person in a suit was deciding what you could or couldn't read. I think the sort of legacy of it, in a sense, is the community that we're in. In a lot of ways, the actions that people went through, the the acts of defiance, the acts of fundraising that people had to sort of come together on to make raise money for this crazy, insanely expensive court case, like the fundraiser after fundraiser after fundraiser. It's all community building stuff. And when you're painting placards with people, when you're planning events with people, you know, you're getting to know the other people in your community and you're building a strong community. And I think that the strong community we have in Vancouver as a gay place and a safe place for queer people to come to, I think is largely because of that case in many ways.
My name is MTS Poppet. I'm a coordinator of Salaam Vancouver Queer Muslim Community. Little Sisters was big because they represented diversity as well. You know, they had tiles of people like Sham Sabadurai and Shani Mutu and people from our community who are writers. And we could go there and read these. And we had people like Sham and Shani who had readings at Little Sisters. And it was part of our connection to the community. And when we, you know, we won those battles, it was a victory for all of us.
When Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 continues,
the scale of the issue is not relevant for constitutional or legal purposes. The judge still has a responsibility to apply the charter, apply the law, and find in our favor.
I was frustrated and angry and sad. And I think the thing that hit me the most is I took it a lot more personal than I thought I would.
Equality loses in another court case. Don't miss This Way Out's next installment of Heather Kitching's award-winning documentary.
Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Tanya Kane Perry, Gene Pembleton, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Janet Mason, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. John Williams and Triumph performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information, pics of the crew, and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGHE Alma, Washington, Radio Reverb, Brighton, England, WRSU, New Brunswick, New Jersey, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.